Well, thank you, Claire. So you told on me, so I have to tell on you. So I'm a young kid making my way in the world of journalism, and Claire's mom was on the local television station here, and the dean of African-American journalists here in Boston at the time, and greatly encouraged me and to move forward in this business, which, well, you know, in this society, truth is a scarce commodity, and if you are engaged in trying to promulgate it, you can get in a lot of trouble. And Sarah Ann took her lumps as well in saying how things were, Sarah Ann Shaw, but inspired me to try to do the same. So it's great to be talking to y'all, to welcome you to Boston. First of all, an historical note or two. We are just steps from where the Boston Tea Party began over here at the Old South Meeting House. That when people decided to confront the truth of what was going on with our relationship with the British, that they took action. And Boston is a town which has been taking action ever since. We got the voting machines to work here. Deval Patrick is governor. And I just have to remind folks that back when I was learning about journalism from Sarah Ann Shaw and the others, that Ed Brooke was United States Senator. Massachusetts is not a Johnny come lately to the notion of opening up the political process. So from the Tea Party to Brooke to Patrick, we try to make things change here, if we can, in Massachusetts. Now, there's something else that I want to point out. About the time that that Tea Party was happening, the house that I now live in southern New Hampshire had already been built. It was built in 1755. This house came with a geothermal heating and cooling system. It had a... Now, you guys are laughing. Let me tell you the story. The house has a big chimney. It's a big pile of rocks. It's right in the middle of the house. It's called a center chimney colonial. Anyone here live in one of these things? Any center chimney folks? All right. And so the temperature of the earth every day, 6 feet down, is what? 65. Close. It's 55. It's 55 degrees, whether it's the middle of the winter or the summer or whatever. And so those old timers, when they built this house on the with this pile of rocks in the middle, had heating and cooling. To this day, I don't need to use air conditioning in that house. And in the wintertime, of course, 55 feels pretty cool, but it is easier to heat. So what has happened from 1755 to today? What have we forgotten? Apparently a lot. Well, hopefully we're going to get back to this, because as you know, the earth is out of balance, and things are in a lot of trouble, mostly because of what we've been doing. And I want to talk primarily about climate change. But first, since we're having lunch, I want to stop for a moment and let anybody in this room... Have we just lost the microphone here? Did we? No? All right, I can use the old lungs here. Okay. For anybody in this room who's feeling guilty about how much you might have had for lunch or the size of your girth, just a little reminder of what we found in the horror. There's increasing evidence that the synthetic chemicals that mimic our hormone system in cascade are affecting known as insulin resistance. Now, people will tell you that if you're chubby, and I'm one of the crowd, if you're chubby, well, you need to diet and you need to exercise. But the fact is that there's increasingly... hello? Hey, this seems to be working. Thank you, sir. Increasingly, it's pretty clear that certain synthetic chemicals interfere with that cascade. Let me just give you a couple of chemicals. Anyone here know what perchlorate is? Yes, sir. That's perk also. Maybe is it used for this? I was thinking of it in another context. Might well be used for that. That's right. It's also widely used for... I guess the MIT guy went home already. It's widely used as rocket fuel. Rocket fuel. So beginning in the last century, I think mostly after the First World War and up into the Second World War, rocket fuel and gunpowder and that sort of thing, this was widely dispersed across America. It is, according to the EPA, in 23 different states. It is, according to the Environmental Working Group, which I hope some of you support, in 40-some-odd states. And it's in the water. It is persistent in the water. And what's more, it's probably right here on our luncheon table for anyone who's having salad. Because if it was grown in the Central Valley, the water that was piped had perchlorate and it stays in the vegetables that it is grown in. Perchlorate, according to the Centers for Disease Control, in the quantities that are found typically in water, has a therapeutic effect of suppressing thyroid function. The most recent study, and you can, of course, can hear this anytime you want on Living on Earth on our website, www.loe.org. You get the details of this story. Perchlorate suppresses thyroid function. There are some, everyone's sitting down, they estimated about 40 million women, why they talked about women is another story in a moment, 40 million women who have had their thyroid function depressed by perchlorate. It's one in three women in this country. One in three women. So when the surveys say, you ask the public what they care about, and you know everyone says the environment's important, but they don't maybe vote for it exclusively on it. But at the end of the day, it's affecting so many of us. One in three women. Why women, by the way? Because of the extra concern that thyroid is very important in the reproduction and gestational process. And kids that don't get the right cascade of thyroid hormone in the process of brain development are in deep trouble. So while an adult may be chubbier as a function of being exposed to perchlorate, the kid may have all kinds of cognitive functioning problems as a result of that. And do we have an epidemic of attention deficit disorder in this society? Do we have an epidemic of all kinds of learning disabilities in this society? Did grandma and grandpa say that they had that amount of problems? No. Perchlorate is one of 500 synthetic chemicals that are involved in interfering with our hormonal cascade. And it's just one example of why it's very important to pay close attention to what's happening in terms of environmental change. Because when the environment changes, it affects all of us. One could extrapolate if it's 40-some-odd million women, perhaps as many men have been affected as well. So, you know, darn, the only thing about this research says is that it doesn't mean that I can have the chocolate cake anyway. What it means is that if I happen to be affected by it, and I haven't had any tests to see if I am, it just means that I'm not going to do so well at metabolizing the chocolate cake. So, unfortunately, it means that I have to be on this diet perpetually. I don't know. You know, the environment is also so hard to look at because it can be so depressing. And, in fact, with my crew in covering stuff like the chemicals or climate change, which is another really cheerful topic we'll explore in a moment, the problem is, when you're a journalist and you cover really difficult things, you know, think about a war. There you are, you get on the plane, you go to, well, these days we know the cities, right? You can go to Kabul, you can go to Baghdad. Of course, you could also, you could go to East Timor. There are all kinds of places where you can go and be in trouble. But guess what? When you're done covering the war, you get to go home. When you cover environmental change and you see what's going on, there is no away. Once you understand, say, the stuff about the chemicals or stuff about climate change, it's part of your life. And it's really hard to look at this stuff. And that's, of course, where the arts can really help, because the arts are a way that we can tell the story of something, feel the pain, and yet feel uplifted at the same time. Because, you know, I tell you one thing about us humans. Despite everything from perchlorate to just so many difficult things, we nonetheless have this indomitable spirit, okay? I mean, isn't it great to be human? I mean, isn't it great? Just think about it. Here we are in a town where – we lost the microphone again. Here we are in a town where we went from – let's see. What's changed in this society just over the past 200-plus years that we've had the United States? Let's see. The British used to – the king used to own the place, right? Then free white men who had property had rights. And then white men had rights. And then black people couldn't be owned anymore by somebody else. Then women got rights. And think what else has happened. You know, the great scourge of humanity has been war historically. Well, guess what? War is out. It's passé. Doesn't work anymore. Now you're looking at me like I've had something, I ate too much of the perchlorate-laced lettuce at lunch. Well, let me ask you this. What country in the world has declared war on another country right now? Where is there one government fighting another legally constituted government? Where? Where? We don't have any declared wars going on right now. Isn't that amazing? I mean, there's all kinds of undeclared BS that we can look to, but there's nothing declared. You know why? Because war is out of date. All you need is someone here. I see a handbag over there. Okay. All you need is a bunch of plutonium and a trigger mechanism, something that size. You can put 10 of them in the top of a missile. You can take one Ohio-class submarine and destroy an entire civilization. So the atom bomb has made war passé. One nation cannot go to war with another and survive. Now think about it. Something as big as that can change? So let's see. If we've stopped owning people, if war has become passé, oh, there is another war that's going on, though. I forgot. Silly me. It's not one government against another. It is the war against nature. We have declared war on nature, or we are effectively in a war on nature, because you know what? We think we can own nature. We think we can actually own nature, that it's possible to somehow take possession of the whole system that gives us life here. I know, it's a pretty crazy notion, isn't it? But that's what we've done. So I want to talk about one of the ways that we have gotten into trouble thinking that we own nature, particularly into thinking that we own the air, okay? That we can privatize and use the air privately, right? Which is what we've done since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution big time by putting what in the atmosphere, folks? Carbon dioxide, CO2. It's funny, you know, when we took chemistry as kids, we were told that CO2 was relatively benign, right? It was a carbon monoxide that would kill you in a few minutes out of the back of a car or something. And that CO2 was wonderful because that's the plant food, right? The plants take the CO2, they make sugars, and photosynthesis feeds us all, and it ends up on that wonderful piece of cake that's on your table, right? Well, here's the thing. And I'll just go through this quickly because I'm sure most of you really know this story, but just pause and think for a moment. The Earth, like us, breathes. Every northern hemisphere summer, those leaves come out, the deciduous trees put out those leaves, they photosynthesize all summer, and they take about 100 gigatons of carbon out of the atmosphere. 100 gigatons of carbon out of the atmosphere. Come the end of the summer, the leaves fall and they start to oxidize and they release that. So the Earth breathes about 100 gigatons worth of carbon a year in and out. But like the kid that's having a cigarette, you know, in the restroom, us humans are adding 6 of those gigatons to the Earth's atmosphere every year, more or less. Most of it we get from what class? From what?
Fluorocarbons.
Fluorocarbons? No. Somebody else I heard? Fossil fuels, yes. Okay. Anybody been in a car in the last 72 hours? Come on, who's been in a car in the last 72 hours? Okay, we've all contributed. Anybody turned on a light in the last 72 hours? Okay. Now, New England does get a lot of electricity from Hydro-Quebec, but this, you know, about half of the electricity in this country comes from coal. Coal has the most carbon density. Something else, though, aside from burning fossil fuels, puts carbon in the atmosphere. What else? It's part of the energy system. Come on, there's something else. Agriculture, yep. All those cows, they actually more directly produce methane, which is a powerful greenhouse gas. So our fascination with grain and with meat is also helping to warm the planet. And there's some evidence that maybe 7,000-8,000 years ago this started when agriculture got going, rather than just at the industrial age. One other thing, though, that really puts a lot of carbon in the atmosphere. This is easy, class. Come on. You all are really shy. Have they been spending too much? How many sessions have you guys been to today? I got news for you. This is a hotel. You can get a room. You can take a nap. All right, let's try again. Come on, does anybody know? Air conditioning, energy system. Come on, this is not in the energy system.
Respiration.
Oh, I thought I heard some. Come on, try. Wood fires, getting close. Yes, wood fires come from? Cutting, who said, what is this?
Say it again.
Cutting down the forest.
Yes. Yes, yes. About a quarter of it comes from cutting down the forest. All right. She gets an A. Now, just in case we're wondering how much trouble this has gotten us in, we are at, I'm going to get the exact numbers wrong, but we started the industrial era with about 280 parts per million of carbon dioxide. We're at 370 million parts per million of carbon dioxide. And if you all saw Al Gore's movie, you know that that's the most CO2 we've had in the atmosphere on the scale of a million years. You can actually get the ice core samples that show some 800,000 years. You can actually document it. But if you look back, it's probably a million, maybe even 2 million years. And just to sort of joggle you a little bit, 2 million years ago was when the East Antarctic ice sheet formed. That's good for 200 feet about of sea level. Now, it'll take a long time to melt all that ice away. Oh, we've lost this again. It seems to go in and out, huh? Okay. Well, I'm going to have to holler, I guess, for a moment. Or we got battery problems?
Yeah, it's harbor frequencies.
We have harbor frequencies? Am I supposed to be a tugboat? But, you know, it's a little hard to think of 200 feet. So let's just think about what science has been telling us has been changing recently and fairly rapidly. So, as you know, Iceland and Greenland are both misnamed, right? If you go to Iceland, it's quite green, and if you go to Greenland, it's mostly ice. Now, there is enough ice in Iceland that seems to be, it is rapidly melting. It's melting at a pace that if you were to, the projections that I've seen are that it would be all gone, the median of when it would all be gone is about 300 years. So the ice that's in Greenland is good for maybe 7 meters, call it 21 feet of sea level. So if you do that in a straight line, let's see, 350 divided by 7, so, you know, you're talking about 3 feet every 50 years, if this is a straight line process, from Greenland alone. So the official UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change projection is that we're going to see something like 3 feet at the end of this present century. But if you look at the melt rate right now in Greenland, we'd probably see it in 50 years. So that means that anybody's kid who's born today might run into, that's a straight line, and you know what? You can't predict. And the trouble with trying to predict climate change in some respects is that you can look at the macro trends, but you can't really look at a precise number. And of course, this is what's been used to for disinformation. I mean, it's just like the economy. I mean, you can say, look at a company and say, well, okay, this company is really losing sales, interest rates are up. Today the stock is say, $50. Probably that stock is going to go down, but no one would ever dare tell you exactly what predict what the price of the stock would be, even the next day, certainly not the next week or the next year or in 10 years or 100 years, because the precision of that would be ridiculous. But anyone would say to you, well, you know what, that stock is going down. So while it probably makes no sense to say, well, we'll see 3 feet in 50 years, because it might be melting faster, it might be melting a little slower, although so far virtually all of the projections have happened faster than what they were initially cast as. I mean, when I started looking at climate change, when Living on Earth started in 1990, we were told, science was saying, well, we ought to be able to actually see the signs of this in another 15 years. But it was about 7, 8, 9 years when the data started coming back that we're really seeing the signs of this happening. So it happens faster than that. But you know what? Greenland isn't the only place that's melting. The West Antarctic ice sheet, which is much smaller, is good for maybe another 5, 6, 7 meters of ice. So you put those together, what are we talking about? We're talking more like someplace on the 3, 6 feet, 9 feet, within maybe the lifetimes of the youngest person in our family. And that, again, that's just a guess. Because I tell you, I got one of these sets of white hair at a meeting with James Hansen, the guy at NASA Goddard in New York, who's gotten into so much trouble from the present administration about talking about the effects of climate change. When he trotted out some data from ice core samples that showed that climate regimes could snap in as little time as 10, 20, 30 years, that the last ice age, the temperature regime might have abruptly changed that quickly. And so this is a very serious problem that needs to have been addressed, needs to be addressed now. Science says we have about a 10-year window to really get a hold of this balance question. Now remember, back at the math, we're contributing about 6 gigatons a year out of this 100 gigaton oscillation. And what happens though, I'm going to try a little more science on you guys. What happens when you start to warm things up? What will happen to all that carbon that's on the ground in soil or in water if it gets warmer? It what? It oxidizes. I hear that word oxidize. Yes! And oxidation means, of course, more carbon dioxide. So there will come a point, as things warm, they'll get warmer. And there'll come a point when the plants that are being oxidized and the plant matter is being oxidized is going to be much larger than the difference that us humans are making, and then at that point we will have no influence. We get to have no influence. So, you know, it's funny, scientists don't like to look at this. I remember being in, or the implications of it. I was in Buenos Aires right after the first Kyoto, after Kyoto was promulgated in 1997, there was a follow-up meeting. And the British have been very active on the question of climate change because, as you know, or you may not know, I guess I should probably tell you the story. The British have much lower carbon emissions than most of the countries in Western Europe for the very reason that Margaret Thatcher shut down the coal miners because they were bad voters for her. Put them on seriously. I mean, it's like, whoa. But when she knocked the coal miners out of business, she immediately knocked down Britain's carbon dioxide profile. And they look really, really good. So they had the head of their climate forecasting unit come to this meeting, along with the Deputy Prime Minister, John Prescott. And they popped some slides up on the wall, and they said, well, you know, by the year 2050, if things keep going the way they are, the Amazon will be gone as a rainforest. It'll be grasslands. And so, you know, being well-trained by Sarah Ann and the Boston Globe crew, I stuck up my hand and says, well, what happens after that? And the scientist glowered at me, and he says, well, we don't know. I says, well, and then, lucky for me, Prescott says, well, we'll find out. So since the scientist boss says find out, it took 2 years later. I'm in Berlin. I run into this guy again at another meeting presentation. So what's the story? What is it like? And he said, okay, well, we started to run the numbers, and if things go the way that they're going, we'll see a planet that is some 14 degrees warmer by the end of the century on average. 14 degrees. 14 degrees. Now, I suppose that doesn't sound like a very big number when it's, you know, 50 outside and it could be 64 or something. For an average temperature, is that, all right. Planet-wise, it's just devastating. It's just devastating. It's a roasted, uh-oh, it's me here. Oh, it's the White House. Oh, he says he sees the light. Oh, well, all right. All right, Mr. President. You know, anybody can change. Well, sorry about that. Look, let's just... It was a very hard moment with the scientist, Jeff Jenkins, his name. And I said, so what does this mean? And how do you, I said, do you have grandchildren, Dr. Jenkins? He says, yeah. So what do you think this will mean for them? He says, you know, I can't think about that. And I'll never forget that because what I saw was, you know, if you've seen the modeling, it shows a pretty toasted planet at that point. And speaking of toasting, by the way, there is there's kind of a dichotomy for the effects of climate change in this country. The western part of the U.S. is feeling this already much more than the east. East is getting a little more rain. The west is either living with more intense El Niños, it seems, or intense drying and more heat. So it's like alternate reality for people in this country. Because if you talk to somebody out west, they're much more attuned. And if they're in a place where water is in short supply, they're really feeling it. They're really feeling it. So there's one other effect, and this comes down to... oh, my. What can I do to... It comes down to... you know, the general circulation out there in the ocean. And the hurricanes that we see so often here in the east get their fuel from the warmer water, right? And so as the temperature has gone up less than a degree in the South Atlantic, we've seen a couple of years of really intense hurricanes. Now, what happened to hurricanes this last year? Where'd they go? Anybody know? Well, they went to Mexico, the Pacific. Actually, the answer is the Pacific on the El Nino. You know, when the El Nino gets going, it kind of blows the tops off of the hurricanes. They can't get going. So this year, because the West is really going to get drenched, this is actually fairly mild El Nino, I think, or that's what I'm told by the Center for Atmospheric Research. But nonetheless, it was enough to hold down the hurricanes. But there was, of course, 2 years of really intense, four for Florida, and then... Then the next year, the big three, Wilma, Rita, and of course, Katrina. And the good thing about Katrina is also the bad thing about Katrina. Katrina, we went down to cover the hurricanes and such, and as we looked closely, we realized that Katrina was not a monster hurricane when it came to New Orleans. The flooding happened as a function of the engineering failures and the some really poor design and then some poor execution. I mean, there were levees built on detritus from Hurricane Betsy, actually. I mean, imagine trying to set concrete on rotting leaves and twigs. That happened in some places. And then plus the channelization of the area. There's a
Mississippi River Gulf outlet next to New Orleans East was, I mean, you ever put your finger over the edge of the hose, you know, to make it squirt? Well, that's exactly what happened to the water coming in the storm surge in towards New Orleans when it hit the Mr. Go, you guys call it in New Orleans. So it was like this jetting effect. Because Katrina was probably only a Category 2, maybe even as little as a Category 1 when it hit New Orleans. Now, when it over to the east in Mississippi and Alabama, and it was, you know, it was full-throated Category 3, and you saw the kind of, I mean, Biloxi in that area just flattened. But, you know, New Orleans wasn't flattened in the first wave of the storm. It was all doing okay until, of course, the water started to rise. I thought for a moment that I would play a little bit of tape. We did a program last year. Every year, we do a storytelling program at the solstice, the holiday season, partly because the environment can be such a challenging thing. It's a little hard to turn on your radio on Christmas morning and hear,
we have another chemical destruction coming along.
So we like to do some storytelling and have a bit of fun. This year it was bittersweet, though, because we thought we should tell some stories out of New Orleans and just how people were going to cope. So we got some singers and we got some storytellers, and actually we had a restaurateur telling us what she was going to cook. And we don't have oodles of time, but I thought if I can get this to work properly, I would I'd just play you a little sequence with a guy who wasn't okay, let's see if this is going to do us. Now, this person was not Tab Benoit is his name. He calls himself a Cajun bluesman. He wasn't in New Orleans. He was from south of there, out in the Bayou country. Ironically, he had done a CD the year before about the threat in New Orleans wetlands. And if you look at the hydrology of the area, you can see that because of changing the direction of the Mississippi River and channelizing it, and also what's been done to get some of the oil out of there, that the barrier islands are gone, the wetlands are gone, that the whole area is exposed to the storms. And he had done this, the CD on the wetlands and the loss of the wetlands in a plea the year before, which obviously wasn't heard in time. One other comment about this. So what happened in New Orleans, what's good about it is that people really opened up their eyes to the prospect of what climate change could do and storm surges could do. What's bad about it, A, is that it happened. It's so horrible. And it's also based on a misperception that somehow monster storms do this. No, this is an ordinary level storm that hit this engineering failure. And I was telling one of my hosts here that, you know, the next Category 3 storm that comes to New York City, the mouth of New York Harbor, is good for 30 feet of water in Lower Manhattan. 30 feet of water in Lower Manhattan. And how many of you have lived or been around Manhattan and remember the subways being flooded in the 70s from those hurricanes? Okay. And that was pretty mild stuff. So actually any coastal city is at risk from this, although if you have really horrible engineering for your systems, you might suffer a worse fate. But then think about the rest of the world where people are too poor to even have these engineering systems. There are tens of millions of people close to sea level in the Bay of Bengal in Bangladesh, for example. So we're all in this together. There is no away from any coastal area we're at risk. Let me see if I can get this little piece to play from Tab Benoit from our program of Christmas time last year. Stay tuned to Living on Earth. It's Living on Earth. I'm Steve Kerwood, and welcome to our Christmas time special, Louisiana Longing. Blues guitarist, Cajun blues guitarist, Tab Benoit is back with me now. How you doing, Tab?
All right.
So, Tab, when I think Cajun country, I think history, the story of the French-speaking people called Acadians who were forced out of Nova Scotia by the British and their journey to the Louisiana Bayou to join the French colony there. Tell me a bit about how Cajun culture got the blues.
Well, first of all, if you go back and listen to traditional Cajun songs and translate the lyrics, those are the saddest songs in the world. It seems like, you know, all these songs are about somebody dies, and a lot of times it's like a kid or, you know, a guy's wife. And if you listen to the way that they're singing, I mean, the traditional Cajun voice, it's like a cry, you know, it's like crying out. You know, that's blues. It comes from the feelings, the bad feelings that we have, and trying to fight your way through it by using music, you know. Everybody kind of lists the things that we're losing right now by all this destruction in South Louisiana, but, you know, nobody seems to be mentioning the music and the culture and the food. I mean, Lord, the only real ethnic American food is Cajun food. It was born right here. And, you know, just the cultural things I find have been kind of pushed aside like they never existed, you know. I mean, this music went worldwide and changed the music of the world. I mean, how important is that, you know?
Before you have to go, Tab, I wonder if you could play us another song.
I sure could try. My sadie, she has left me for good. After I gave her my love for so long, she's out there with somebody new. And I just can't sit here alone, no, no. But it's so hard to drive with these tears in my eye, and it takes a long time to get to Baton Rouge. And all I want is to hear old Rafe O'Neal sing my song. Lord, when a Cajun man gets the blues. When I'm feeling the way of the water, Lord, I know that there's blues in the quarter. If I could hold back my tears and make it there, I'd be all right. But I might need you, New Orleans, every night. And I don't know where I'd be without you. When you've been there for me all the while, from Lafayette to Thibodeau to Lake Charles, hey, from Cocodrie to Ticayu to Grand Isle. Now when I'm feeling the pain, the bayou's calling my name, and that's an offer that I can't refuse. I say it's hard to miss you, Louisiana. Lord, when a Cajun man gets the blues, I say it's hard to miss you, good old Louisiana. Oh, when a Cajun man got the blues.
That was great. That was really just terrific.
Thank you, man.
Tab Benoit, that must be the song that you play when you want to bring the house down.
I tell you, that's the place where I wrote that song, The House Is Down. You know, I wrote that out of my camp, and it's flattened and leveled by the tidal surge from Hurricane Rita. So it's always meant a lot to me, you know, it's that song in particular, because I think it was just a matter of you know, my heart speaking out as to how I felt about where I live and where I come from. and trying to put all of it into perspective, not just for everybody else, but for myself, you know. So it's a very special song to me, and it's actually a hard one to sing right now, you know, and a hard one to play. It's not that easy to jump into it, but it's more important than it's ever been, you know, and it's just an example of the kind of things that we don't want to give up on, and the things that we want to try to preserve, and the things that we want to try to say and be honest about, you know. It's basically getting your heart out there and being naked to the world and letting everybody see your true self and what you're about, you know. And songs have a way of doing that.
Indeed. With me has been Cajun blues guitarist Tab Benoit. Tab, it's been really great having you. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
No problem. Thanks for having me. It's great to talk to y'all. I hope we get to do some more of these things, you know.
We make a good gumbo. Make a good gumbo. With the love and touch. Love and touch. From New Orleans. From New Orleans. Way down to the gulf. Way down to the gulf.
So, you know, for me, there's a couple more from that show, too. It may sound like I'm in the same room with him, but he was actually in a studio in New Orleans, and I was here in our studio in Somerville. And it just seemed so. It was really hard to hear. I mean, I just loved it, and it was so hard to hear. And I mean, the arts really can do that for us—a way to tell the story. And to hear his song morph from, you know, a man's lost his woman to a man has lost his country. His earth, his territory. Now, there are some really wonderful things going on, though. I want to talk a bit about them in just the remaining minutes that I have. But I'm going to start with a bit of a warning. Some people are very happy about what's happened politically in this country. But just a reminder of the fact that the environment is not the province of one political party or the other. In fact, I have to forgive Al Gore for not standing up in 2000 at the Kyoto negotiations when the U.S. showed up with a totally unreasonable negotiating position, and the talks fell apart. And you know, we could have acceded to the Kyoto Treaty, and it would have been out of George Bush's hands. It would have been in the Senate's hands for ratification, but would have been out of George Bush's hands. But it didn't happen then. And we just did a show this last week on the election, and John Dingell will be head of the Energy Committee, a gentleman from in the House who's from Michigan. And he has, for years, opposed CAFE standards, opposed all kinds of measures that would limit greenhouse gas emissions. So there's plenty of there's bipartisanship failures of omission here. There's plenty to go around. But the public process can, in fact, make a huge difference. And let me just close by pointing out a possible mechanism, even a suggestion. Now, I'm going to guess that most of the people here own or at least have a direct deal with a bank, the place that you live, right? How many folks here own or at least have some kind of a mortgage on a place you deal directly with? Okay. Now, I won't ask how many of you just simply paid cash for your houses. But that's what we're asking people to do with climate-friendly technologies that we have today. Because going back to geothermal, there is plenty of 55-degree earth down there that using heat pumps, and a heat pump is nothing more, you know, you've got one in your home, it's a refrigerator, right? But a ground-coupled heat pump using water or those is much more efficient. There's plenty of heating and cooling right down there if we simply use heat pumps to get at it. There's plenty of sunlight that we can use solar cells to capture that electricity, make electricity that way, or to heat our hot water. But if anyone's ever looked into installing one of these systems in your home, you're looking at $20,000, $50,000, $100,000 to do it. Now, why are we able to get home mortgages? Well, there is, among other things, these federal guarantees for aggregation of these loans in the secondary market. You can buy a Ginnie Mae. So if you all are involved with foundations, maybe your investment committee has for, you know, fixed income instruments, has some Ginnie Mae's or other types of bonds, okay? So why don't we take advantage of that process so that we could finance, give people long-term loans to put in carbon, low-carbon or no-carbon energy systems? Let's see, what would the advantages of such things be? Your heating bill would never go up again. How about that? What if you didn't have to worry if there was a war or a hurricane, depending on your energy bill, huh? What if you just pay the same amount every month? Let's see, what's with it? To install that, you have to have local people do the work, right? I mean, you'd create jobs. I mean, how are you going to outsource to the Philippines putting these solar cells on your roof? And then, of course, almost 40% of the greenhouse gas emissions that we get from this country come from heating and cooling operating our buildings. Science tells us we need to cut emissions by maybe 50-60% very soon to avoid the difficulties that we're facing with climate change. So if we could really make our buildings climate friendly, it would go a long distance. So, and then what I like about using a guarantee program for something like mortgages is that it requires really little, if any, expenditure from the public treasury. So, I mean, what's the default rate on long-term loans? What's the default rate on long-term loans that are involved with homes? I mean, anyone want to guess? I don't know, but anyone want to guess? I mean, it's what? Less than 1%. So let's say that this program was really poorly run and there was a 5% default in the program. That would mean for every $1 billion worth of low carbon or no carbon infrastructure you'd construct. And by the way, conservation is the place to begin. There are just so many things we can do with efficiency. The public might have to pay $50 million to get $1 billion of low-carbon infrastructure, $50 million. I mean, what a deal. I mean, what I'm talking about is making it possible for people to buy these systems at the same out-of-pocket cost that they spend right now for, say, the electric bill and the heating bill. And I'm guessing it's, you know, 20, 25, 30-year note will be necessary to do that. Now, like a house, you'd probably pay two or three times as much as the capital cost. But if the cash flow is the same as what you're spending now for energy, would you care? I certainly wouldn't. And I could update my geothermal system in my house, the 1755 model, to something that's a little more contemporary. And we could turn around our carbon footprint very quickly using these kinds of mechanisms. Oh, and by the way, we don't have to go off to that outdated mechanism known as war or conflict to get the energy as well. No one has yet figured out a way to meter the sun. Maybe they'll come up with it, but not yet. No one's metering the earth. So it's not like we don't have solutions in hand. We have the technology. We have the need. And think about the kind of society we would have if we took these steps. Because to do this by building local economies, by reducing our conflict with other folks over energy, by reducing pollution, and I mean, we didn't even talk about the toxic side of using coal to generate electricity. Some 30,000 people a year die from particulates associated with that coal that makes these lights go on and this microphone work. I mean, there are all these benefits that can come from this. All we have to do is take the steps. All we have to do is open ourselves to the possibilities. And to close, telling the story and telling it artistically, because, you know, thinking abstractly about New Orleans getting flooded out is one thing. Hearing Tab Benoit stories, or there's some other stories I could play for you, is another. It becomes real. It becomes real. Tab, that must bring the house down. Well, let me tell you, Rita brought my house down. But we can build ourselves up. We can uplift ourselves if we're willing to move forward. And you guys are in a great position to do this in the organizations that you are with. So thank you so much for inviting me.
You out of time?
Okay. Thank you. Very generous of you. I guess we have a few minutes for just a couple of questions, if anybody has an inquiry for any of this. And if there are no takers, then you can get on to your raffle. I understand that there's a Defense Department Secretary in here. Anybody want to take him home? Just kidding. There must be a question. Oh, right back here.
Not so much a question, but a way of, I think, underscoring the tie-in between the work that we do in the arts and culture and environmental conservation. And, I mean, in some ways it seems so obvious, but I also know, having been an environmental funder, how often people in environmental grant making talk about, well, what are the levers or the levers in a system that we need to press upon to create global shift in thinking so that we embrace environmentalism? And it always comes back to culture. And so underscoring how important we are as partners and thinking about how we can make worldwide changes.
Oh, thank you. That's Angie Kim, in case you don't recognize her from the board here. Anyone else with a comment or a question? Yes, sir.
I just have a quick comment that a lot of my friends who are craftspeople are starting to think about the idea of putting the carbon footprint on their crafts or on their pots as a way of marketing, but as a way of saying, like, well, you know, you can go to Crate and Barrel and buy some beautiful pots that were from the Far East and their carbon footprint is huge, or you can buy my pots and they're more expensive, but the carbon footprint is much smaller. So I think that's kind of interesting for the crafts community.
All right. One more before we close, or are we all set? Y'all are so shy today. Oh, right here.
I was just wondering if you have any thoughts about how to really engage diverse communities in the concerns around the environment, just because I think, generally speaking, the environmental movement has been very dominated by European Americans, and how we need to engage a lot of folks around this.
Do we have the afternoon? Well, the short version, the problem is this. Teddy Roosevelt, in his book, Winning the West, says that the West won't be won until it is free of the yellow, red, and brown, and black man. And that's the genesis, that's among the forefathers of the present environmental movement. So, but like I said at the opening of my remarks, you know, we've come from a society where we used to own people. There is, of course, the environmental justice movement, which simply says that whatever you do to the least of us, you do to us all. And I think that community is widening. There are more and more people who are realizing that this is yet another way that discrimination takes place, and that there are very strong, someone mentioned leverage, there are very strong points of leverage. It's also a way that I think that the majority of society may be starting to wake up. I'll just mention a little factoid here. Lead. The amounts of lead to which, in this town and many cities, the kids of color are exposed to, 95% of kids have been exposed to enough lead to effectively double the crime rate in that population of people. If you look at the research out of the Children's Hospital in Cincinnati, following a cohort of kids from before birth to now they're in their early 20s, about twice the crime rate. So this is a way that I think as communities understand how important it is to get toxins out, because it does affect people's behavior, I think there'll be a lot more buy-in from minority communities have said, well, you know, I can't think about the environment today, I need a job. When in fact the reason it may be hard to get a job or keep a job may be because of the environment. So I think the awareness is growing. But of course the environmental organizations have to open themselves up to this. They haven't historically been all that open. And I remember in 1970 that when the first Earth Day came along, some friends had to drag me out to the demo because I didn't want to go. I was busy marching for civil rights. I was busy marching for women's rights. I was busy marching against the war in Vietnam. The only trouble is that since that day in 1970, a lot has happened with civil rights. Hey, Deval Patrick. A lot has happened with women's rights, although Nancy Pelosi, well, she'll be second in line to become president of the United States. And if things happen, she could move on up the ladder. you guys think that's funny. The war in Vietnam ended, although we've gotten into certainly a round of foolishness since then. But we had 2.5 billion people on the planet and a much healthier planet on that day of the march, and it's much worse today. The environment's the only thing that's really gotten much worse from those causes. So that's why I've involved myself as a journalist in this, because and I'm running into more and more folks who are seeing that, oh, yeah, we better pay attention to this or we won't be able to deal with the other stuff. But excellent question. Thank you. Thank you all so much.